Hi, Matthew. Welcome to the show.
It's really good to be here.
How was Ancient Future formed?
The band was formed in 1978 by four musicians who were studying Indian classical music at the Ali Akbar College of Music in San Rafael. I had come out to California to study there with my friend from fourth grade, Benji Wertheimer, who quickly became one of Zakir Hussain's best students. And we ended up moving into the house where the Diga Rhythm Band had rehearsed. The Diga Rhythm Band was an amazing percussion group featuring Mickey Hart and Zakir Hussain, along with a lot of Zakir's best students. Zakir was off on the road with Shakti at the time, but we ended up forming a band with the other members of the Diga Rhythm Band and Benji and myself, and that was called Greenhouse Intergalactic. And we had one performance with Zakir Hussain was playing on the bill, and we had a song in 13/8, 13 beats, which is a difficult and challenging rhythm. And it had a tihai, which is a rhythmic cadence which goes three times and lands on the first beat of the rhythmic cycle. Well, we blew that tihai rather badly, and the band was so ashamed to have blown the tihai in front of Zakir Hussain that it broke up the next day. And I was able, out of the ashes of that, to start Ancient Future. So, in a way, since the Diga Rhythm Band is an offshoot of the Grateful Dead, and Ancient Future is an offshoot of that, we're really an offshoot of an offshoot of an offshoot of the Grateful Dead.
Now, you're celebrating 30 years of being around as a band. Was it challenging for you to stay true to your musical vision despite ever-changing musical trends?
It hasn't been hard to stay true to our musical vision, because the musical vision is world fusion music, and we're a band dedicated to a process, not a trend or a genre. So, and I think following trends is a bad idea in music. That's how music actually starts getting into a loop where it's looking at itself and imitating itself, and it just kills the muse. So we've never been interested in really being with the trends or anything like that. We're purely interested in what our mission is, which is the process of world fusion music and cross-cultural collaboration.
Tell us a little bit about your background when it comes to guitar playing. You know, I hear a lot of John McLaughlin in your playing. Did he actually play a major role in your musical development?
My first main influences in terms of guitar players were not guitar players named John, but rather guitar players named Jimmy, specifically Jimi Hendrix and Jimmy Page. I started the guitar when I was 12 years old, and I spent the first year really studying the music of Jimi Hendrix. At the end of that year, I got the feeling that I wanted to learn about jazz and classical music, with the idea of gaining some musicianship from doing that, to use that in my rock playing, and maybe to do some fusions of jazz and classical and rock music. So I embarked on a journey where I bought all the Joe Pass guitar books I could find and went through them and joined the jazz band at the school and got a classical guitar teacher and studied classical guitar. And I was having a lot of fun with that process when I came across the Mahavishnu Orchestra record and also Chick Corea. And they were both doing some amazing work in jazz rock fusion. And I got really excited by that, because here were some people who were doing what I had decided I wanted to do. So John McLaughlin really reinforced for me that that was a good path to be on. He also opened me up to angular music, because I hadn't really heard much like that before. He plays very fast and very angular lines. And at first I didn't actually like them, because they just didn't really speak to me emotionally. But the more I listened to them, the more I grew to like them. And I felt like even if you were to take those very fast angular lines, if you were to slow them down, they'd still mean something. And so he opened me up to that in my playing as well. over the course of time, I, of course, was influenced by a lot more musicians than just John McLaughlin and Jimmy Page and Jimi Hendrix. And so I was learning from, you know, the jazz greats and Ravel and Debussy, and these were a lot of my influences. And I noticed that what I liked to do in music was to fuse different traditions. And in high school, I thought, well, why stop with just Western traditions? Why not fuse traditions from all around the world? And so I started to learn about Indian music as one of the first traditions I was interested in. And then I heard Shakti, so he was ahead of me there again. And I was just blown away by what he was doing with Shakti. I thought it was really beautiful. Although I do have to say, I didn't really like the first Shakti album that much because his guitar was buzzing all over the place. And at that time, I thought that a buzz was a mistake. And to me, John McLaughlin shouldn't be putting out records that had mistakes on them. I've definitely gotten over that feeling by now. But anyway, so the other thing that was an influence for me was he was using a scalloped fretboard guitar with Shakti. And later, when I came out to the Alipur College of Music to study Indian music, I ended up having my guitar scalloped so that it would make it easier to do the note bends that are needed in Indian music. So there's quite a few ways he has been a big influence on my musical development. Although, in terms of my choice of notes and my composition, not really so much. It's more that he's been an influence in that he was doing things that I wanted to do, and it gave me encouragement for me to do them too.
Matthew, what kind of music did you listen to growing up?
I have a brother who's old enough to be my dad, and when I was in my crib, he had a folk band, and he used to come over and play guitar and sing to me while I was in my crib. And this got me really turned on to the guitar. I always wanted to play the guitar so badly. I'm sure that's why I ended up being a guitar player, was because of his influence. And so I was exposed to Pete Seeger and the whole folk music revival and everything that was happening in that regard. And he also ran an underground newspaper as I was growing up, and did the music reviews, so he would bring all the latest music that was happening. I'm sure that's how I found out about Jimi Hendrix. And so it's a pretty standard American background of music in that regard, although my mom liked jazz, and so we had a lot of jazz records, and we had a lot of classical records as well. In school, they used to teach us about classical music. It was part of our courses. We had music class 3 times a week, so I was exposed to Western classical music there, and I found it very interesting. So I had that as a background too. And then my dad used to bring home 45s of popular television theme songs. So I remember having the theme song to Hawaii Five-0 and putting that on a little 45 and dancing around to that when I was a little kid. So kind of a range of music that I heard when I was very young.
You mentioned your father. Were your parents musical at all? Did they have any musical aspirations or any kind of musical background?
Neither of my parents was especially musical, although my mom in her youth had dated jazz musicians, so she had a real love for music. My mom was just so enthusiastic about music. Of course, my older brother was a musician, and he's old enough to be my dad, so that is sort of like having a parent who's into music. And then it was my dad who taught me my first song, which was Frère Jacques. My dad had gone to college in France and had learned to speak French. And so he used to sing to me in French. And when my parents passed, I ended up playing music for both of them in different ways. When my mom was passing. She was in a hospice, and we knew she was going, and so I was able to serenade her, similar to what I did on my Seven Serenades for Scalloped Fretboard Guitar record. And that meant a lot for me to do that, and it seemed to mean a lot to her, too. And then, unfortunately, when my dad passed, I wasn't able to be there, but I had a concert in a cave that was coming up soon thereafter, so I made a little memorial at that, and I actually did a serenade to him where I took the Frère Jacques theme and played it on the scalloped fretboard guitar. You might want to hear that. It's just a mono recording done in a tunnel in Golden Gate National Recreation Area.
That was so beautiful. Really enjoyed that. Let's talk about your guitars, Matthew. How many do you have, and which one is your favorite?
I have seven guitars. There's a couple of electric guitars, a classical guitar, a flamenco guitar, and one of my favorites is the scalloped fretboard guitar. Now, what is a scalloped fretboard guitar? It's an instrument that combines aspects of the South Indian veena and the steel string guitar. The South Indian veena has frets embedded in wax, and when you play the strings and fret, your finger only touches the string because the frets are very high, and this allows you to have greater control over note bending ornaments. And so what we've done on the guitar is to hollow out the wood in between the frets so that when your finger touches the string, you only touch the string, and the pad of the finger never touches the fretboard. Therefore, there's no friction caused by the fretboard, and it just gives you a little bit more control over your note bending ornaments. I was able to study for one summer, three days a week with a South Indian veena master right after having my fretboard scalloped by Luther Irvin Somogyi. This was back in 1979, summer of 1979, when I got the opportunity to study with K.S. Subramanian. So I've been playing the scalloped fretboard now for 30 years, and it's really a big part of my style.
Are there any downsides to playing this particular kind of guitar?
The one thing the scalloped fretboard guitar doesn't do very well, though, is to consistently play a note in between the frets. If you have a note in a scale that's a quarter tone sharp, for example, you can pre-bend before you pick and then pick the string and you can get that note. But for fast scale passages, that's a very difficult technique to master. Where I've just got a new guitar that really solves this problem for me. It's called a Glissantar, and it has no frets at all. And it's a double string instrument. So it's very similar to the oud. It's nylon strings, double string, and it's really great for playing Arabic music. It allows me to get notes easily that were really difficult to get on the scalloped fretboard guitar. So I've been really having a lot of fun with the new instrument. And in fact, I'd like to play some for you. This is an improvisation on the glissantar.
Stuck on a desert island, what would be some of the recordings that you'd take along with you?
Well, I have quite a collection of guitar picks, so I think it might be a little bit difficult to figure out just the right ones to take to a desert island. I'd probably bring my hand-carved ebony guitar picks, which were made in Bali for me by the musicians that I was working with on the Natural Rhythms recording when I was there in 1980. And I'd also probably bring some Jim Dunlop guitar picks with the alligator logo on them. They have a texture that's like alligator skin, and it sticks in your hand very easily, so it doesn't fly out while you're playing. So I like those a lot. But this probably isn't the question you really wanted me to answer. You probably want to know what recordings I'd bring to a desert island. And there again, my first thing that I would want would be a guitar so that I could play some music. But assuming I had that, then I would bring a representative recording from each of the great musical traditions. For example, for North Indian music, I'd probably bring the Raga Guide, which is a guide to 74 ragas, and it includes a book and four CDs. So That would definitely be on the list. And then I'd search for something like that for each tradition. I'd want a really great recording of flamenco music, a great recording of Brazilian music. For each great tradition, I'd want something that was representative. Because the traditions are where the knowledge is, and that would allow me to study the music. And then I'd have my guitar so I could create my own music. Then I'd be covered. So that's how I could be kept happy on a desert island.
What are you listening to these days?
Right now I'm producing a record for Patty Weiss, who's one of the violinists with Ancient Future. And the concept for the record is global gypsy jazz, looking at the interface between jazz and nomadic peoples. And so I've been listening to a lot of Django Reinhardt. I've been listening to a lot of flamenco rumba, and learning the different flamenco rumba parts on the guitar, because there's a fair amount of that on the recording. There's an amazing musician in a band called Azza, who his name is Feta, and he's working on the project with us, and I've been listening to his music. He's from Morocco. And I've been listening to Dizzy Gillespie, and just having a really great time actually listening to a lot of interesting music.
Tell us some more about the role that nomadic people play in the whole scheme of things when it comes to music.
One of the things about nomadic peoples is that they really do a lot for music. And one of the reasons is cross-cultural collaboration. When people are moving around, they come in contact with the music of different cultures. And in moving from one culture to another, they tend to spread some of those musical ideas. So their music becomes very rich. I think that's one of the reasons flamenco music is so deep and it has so much to it rhythmically and so much beauty. It's just rich because of all the cultures that came together to make it happen. So this new CD is exploring kind of a global approach to that in relationship to jazz.
Probably the greatest tool that a musician has these days is the internet. Now, how has the internet changed the way that you stay in touch with fans and other musicians, and also how you go about the process of making music? There must be a real shift for musicians in how the internet has propagated that particular process.
The internet's been a bit of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's really helped with communications between musicians from all around the world. Email makes that a lot easier. And it also makes direct communication between artists and their fans possible. So it is possible for direct support to happen between fans and musicians. However, it has decimated the recording industry. File sharing and piracy have just made the whole ecosystem disappear that was supporting music. And the direct support of fans has not made up for what's been lost. We've lost recording studios, we've lost record labels. There are all these support people that were helping artists to do their jobs, and that has disappeared. Now the artists have to do that themselves. And so there's a lot more work that each artist has to do because of the internet, and now each artist is competing with a lot more artists who are mostly hobbyists who have jobs. So overall, it's done more to hurt support for music than to help it. So we're at an unusual time in history in that our technology has gotten to the point that it is amazing and it can do so many things, but how we use it is the key. And we're not going to go back to a time when we weren't using computers, but at the same time, we need to learn to use computers well. Right now, they seem to be using us more than we're using them. We're getting a trend towards faster and faster communication of shorter and shorter things. Twitter, sound bites. So people are spending a lot of time on their computer and not so much time face-to-face. So I think in terms of the quality of cross-cultural collaboration that we're getting, it's lowered. People are collaborating musically over the internet, but they're sending loops back and forth and doing overdubs. They're still not face-to-face collaborating with people. They're not learning as much. They're just in their rooms in a loop with themselves and their computer, and they have some interaction from other people on the computer, but it's really not the same as face-to-face interaction. And for music, you need everybody in the same room. And that's why one of the reasons a lot of the computer collages that are happening today really do lack soul. There's a whole movement of, I don't know, globalista techno, you might call it. And I think that movement does some good. One of the things that it's doing is showing, you know, cultures working together. But on the other hand, because it's all being done on the computer, we're not getting that humanness. We're not getting the level of musicianship that you get when musicians work together. We're not getting a lot of the heart. And musicians aren't learning from each other in the same way as if they actually play together instead of just sending loops back and forth.
So So in your view, the internet has really shifted things, musically speaking, and it's really affected the way that we record music and the whole process that's involved as well.
I really think a lot's being lost right now, and we have to find a way to use the technology to help music and to help the world rather than let it alter us. So I think it's important to get the click tracks out of recordings to get people back into performing live. And you can't do that if everybody's recording at home because people just don't have, you know, the isolation and the studio space and all that that they need. So if you're recording at home, you're going to rely on loops and samples and things like this a lot more, and not so much live band playing.
So what is Ancient Future doing to deal with this dilemma?
What we're doing with Ancient Future is we're trying to set up a system so our fans can band together to support us directly. And we have a subscription service for our next recording. We're trying to raise the money in advance so that we can have rehearsals and go into a recording studio and play live. And we need to raise a lot of money to do that. We're hoping our fans will support us. So we really need people to put their money where their mouth is and to really help out. And that's you can find out about that at ancient-future.com.
Do you see anything positive coming out of this?
There has been some success in this regard with the internet helping a movement to prosper. One example is progressive rock. That was a movement that had millions and millions of fans in its heyday. And however, the music industry decided that it didn't want to support it anymore, that it was only interested in big hits, leaving millions of fans without new recordings and without tours of their favorite bands. So when the internet came around, the fans were able to band together and provide some support for the music. You know, maybe a fan was now making a lot of money in the computer industry and would be willing to put $5,000 up to help their favorite band get to his city. So that's something that we're hoping that people who are supporting the idea of cross-cultural collaboration between musicians will do with us if they will go to our website at ancient-future.com and check out our plans. Maybe they'll support it directly, and we definitely need all the help we can get on that. So that's our hope for turning the internet into a positive thing for world fusion music.
Matthew, how do you go about selecting musicians for Ancient Future?
Well, selecting the musicians who perform with Ancient Future has always really been an organic process. It tends to happen out of a meeting. Maybe I hear a musician at a concert and end up meeting them backstage, and we get to talking, and it turns out, you know, they're going to be in the area for a while, and so we meet up and perform or record or rehearse. Or I've met people at music camps, or I get hired to play a gig with somebody and there's another musician at also hired, and I meet that musician that way. And then it just grows from there.
Does the internet play a role when you're selecting musicians?
Hasn't been so much a case of people meeting me over the internet. It's more been an organic thing that happens.
Now, a few years ago when I started listening to Ancient Future, I was always struck by your name and how you came about to choosing that name. So what's the story behind Ancient Future?
We had a lot of brainstorming sessions when Ancient Future was first formed. Bands sit around for hours and hours thinking of names. It's a really common band practice when something's first forming. And we had a lot of fun doing it, but we weren't coming up with much. And at one point, Phil Fong, who was our sorodist, he kept saying that we needed to get ancient into the name because of all the he was really into ancient civilizations and the thought that in the past maybe humanity had come farther than we give it credit for, and certainly in music that's true, and these are ancient traditions that we're working with. And so I had the idea that since we're taking ancient traditions and taking the musical knowledge from them and combining them in new ways, hopefully to create the music of the future, that we should just call it Ancient Future. And so that's the truth of how the band was named. I know most people think, you know, must have to do with a time machine or, but it's nothing like that. It's really just talking about ancient traditions into future possibilities.
So in effect, it really is like a time machine, ancient future.
So I guess in a way we do have a time machine now that I think about it, because we take the music of the past and bring it into the future. It's kind of a one-way time machine, though. It only goes one direction.
How did ancient future change your life?
Well, that's a pretty difficult question to answer, because it's hard for me to imagine what my life would have been like had I not done ancient future. I knew before the band even started that I wanted to dedicate my life to the process of world fusion music. So I guess if I hadn't started ancient future, I would have started some other band some other place. And then the music would have developed under different circumstances and different things would have happened. But I'm glad I started Ancient Future here and that we did what we did when we did it, because it's been a fulfilling mission to be on. And I'm proud of what we've done over the first 30 years.
There must have been many musical experiences that stand out for you over the years. What would be your most memorable one?
Well, I had a recent musical experience that definitely stands out. The first time I went on a concert tour of India was quite an experience. In the first show that we were doing, I was backstage getting ready to perform, and just had my black t-shirt on, and my performance jacket was in the dressing room, and we were checking the mics. And I was there with Pandit Habib Khan, the sitar master, and he had brought some of his students along. And as we were checking the mics, one of the students brought me some music and said, Matthew, at the last rehearsal, which I couldn't get to because my plane was leaving at the wrong time to make that rehearsal. Turns out what they had done, instead of solidifying what was already written, Pandit Habib Khan had written an entire new section to the raga that he was going to play at the beginning of the concert. And they just gave me the music written down in the Indian notation system called Sargam right then as we were checking the mics. And I looked down at this music, and it was not really going to be playable on the guitar without a year's worth of work. And I'm looking down at this music wondering, what am I going to do here, when the curtain went up? And this is my first performance in India. And I look out, and the concert hall is filled. And in the front row, everybody has a pen and paper. They're media and critics. And I'm looking down at this music that's not going to be playable and out at this audience. And then I look over, and there's Swapan Chaudhary, who's an amazing tabla player who works with Alec Berkhan. He's on stage with us. There's a famous Indian film singer on stage with us. She's a film singer and also a classical singer. Her father is on stage with us. He's a famous guru. And then there's a two-story high picture of his father, who was the main guru of music in the town we were in. And this is my first time in India, and there's the critics out in the audience, and I wondered, what am I going to do? And I realized I wasn't going to be able to play the music that was in front of me, and I was going to have to play something else. So I waited my turn to put something in there instead, and that turn never came. At a certain point, I realized I'm going to have to butt in. And so I waited for the right moment, and then I played 30 seconds of something I just created on the spot that I thought would fill the purpose of what was written, but, you know, it wasn't what was written. And I got thunderous applause. I thought, okay, that went well. That's good. And then the classical piece was over, and it was time for what I was actually hired to do, which was a set of Indian jazz music. But that set didn't happen because the classical set went over and it was forgotten about, and they called an intermission. So I didn't get to do the jazz set that I'd come all the way to India for. So the next concert was a big jazz festival with 5,000 people there. And so we're still going to do the classical set, but it was supposed to only be 20 minutes. And then we would do the jazz set. So, you know, we had a lot of discussions how we wouldn't go over with the classical set and we'd do the jazz set. So I kept my part down to like 15 seconds because I really wanted to play the jazz set and I didn't want to be adding any extra time. But as it happened, the classical set went an hour and a half instead of 20 minutes because there was 5,000 people in the audience. We were playing at the Gateway of India. The moon was coming up over the Indian Ocean. And it was just a beautiful setting, and the mood was there, and Pandit Habib Khan played so beautifully, and I got my thunderous applause for my 15 seconds out of that hour and a half. And then the concert promoter came over and said, "I'm sorry, but we've gone over time, and we won't be able to do the jazz set." This was at the jazz festival. So at this point, for our third concert, I decided that I was not going to play in the same way I played before, that I was going to play like I saw the taxi drivers drive in India. Anytime there was a briefest opening in traffic, they went right into it, and I decided that's what I was going to do with the music. So on our third concert, I did that, and every time I butted in, I got thunderous applause, and the classical set, instead of being an hour and a half, was only 45 minutes. Paradoxically, when I played more, the set was shorter. And so we got to play the jazz set, and when we did that, we got the biggest response I've ever gotten in my entire life for any concert I've ever done anywhere. The audience was so into the music, and they really appreciated what I was doing that was Indian in nature, because they understand the tradition of North Indian classical music, obviously in India. So whenever I was doing something that was from that tradition, they knew I was doing it. And they were really into that. And yet at the same time, when I would do something different, they knew I was doing something different. And they appreciated that as well, from the point of view of it being exotic to them. So it was just a wonderful experience where I just got to really be appreciated and really feel like I was in tune with the audience, and the audience was in tune with us, and the musicians were all playing very well together, and we just were, you know, playing off of each other and going around in a circle, improvising, and it was just a beautiful experience. So I'd say that's one of the best experiences I've had.
When you were growing up, do you remember the most memorable concert you ever attended?
Well, I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, and we used to go to the Denver Symphony every now and then. There were some really nice concerts in that regard. The University of Colorado in Boulder had some really nice concerts at the university there. And then we did get some amazing rock concerts that came into town from time to time. I got to see the Jefferson Airplane, and later the band Yes. There was an amazing bassoon rock band called Griffin that opened up for maybe Yes or Emerson, Lake and Palmer, or one of Gentle Giant, or one of the progressive rock bands. That was an amazing show.
I have to tell you that Griffin was one of my most favorite bands from that period. They had a unique sound that I've never really heard from any other band since. They were quite something.
I got to see B.B. King, and that was an amazing experience for me because it was so amazing how B.B. played with so much soul. I remember when he came out on the stage, at first they had this amazing jazz guitar playing in his band, jazz blues guitarist. And before B.B. came out, this guitar player was playing amazing blues jazz lines as an introduction to B.B. King. And then B.B. King came out and they said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the king of the blues." And B.B. King came out and played one note, and it had so much soul that it actually blew away this amazing guitar player, which up to that time had been the best guitar player I'd ever seen, was the backup guy in B.B. King's band. And yet B.B. King played one note and it just touched everybody's soul so much. So I think that was the first time I'd really known the power of one note and how much power there can be in just one note. And later in Colorado, I also got a chance to see the band Shakti when they came on tour and performed in the Glenn Miller Ballroom. That was an amazing show. Charles Mingus came to our high school and performed, and I got to meet him. And he's a very gruff man, but boy, he could play. And his band was amazing. That was an amazing show. I feel very fortunate to have been able to see him play as well.
When you're recording an album, do you record live in the studio?
I really prefer recording live whenever possible, but that's not always what actually happens. For my solo CD, Seven Serenades for Scalloped Fretboard Guitar, that was recorded at home, and it was recorded live, mostly just me performing by myself, but also sometimes with one other musician. And there were a few overdubs on that. And that one, it was no pre-production at all. We improvised it all, or in the case of one piece, Sangria by Mariah Parker, she was invited over to put some drones down as background for guitar improvisation, but she sneakily brought over a piece of music she just composed, and we recorded that instead, so I hadn't seen it before. So I got to have a beautiful composition on my album without planning, and so that was very nice. Planet Passion was recorded at home as well, and because of the limitations of my recording studio, it was one or two musicians at a time. So it took forever, and I don't want to do that again. It's just way too time-consuming. It's one thing to record an album one musician at a time with the aesthetic of techno or using loops and samples or drum machines and that sort of aesthetic. But if your aesthetic is live music and you want that ensemble to sound like it's performing live, it's really hard to record one instrument at a time. You often have to record and then re-record parts later because, you know, when you're performing live, everybody's listening to each other and it affects how you play. So, you know, in Planet Passion, I went back and recorded over, you know, parts to make sure that by the end, you know, there was a full circle had been reached, that we got in the musical collaboration as if we'd performed live. So it just took a lot longer. And then on Sangria, that was all recorded live in studio, and we had a lot of rehearsals first with the musicians, and then just laid it down live. And she had the money saved up to go into a studio and pay everybody and do that. So that was really fortunate that she had that money saved up for her project, and we were able to do it that way, because I do think that's the best way to record a record.
I find that your recording sounds so clean and focused.
Thanks so much for the compliments about how focused the recordings are. I definitely spent a lot of work on each recording, you know, on the production, you know, in Planet Passion, there was a lot of pre-production. On Sangria, there was a lot of rehearsal, and then there was the recording, and then I mixed it at home and spent a lot of time really working on making sure you could hear each instrument. And then on Seven Serenades, there was no pre-production because it was all improvised, and I was the engineer too. So I had to spend a lot of time post-production on that, really working on the sound afterwards. And I developed some new techniques where I made every EQ adjustment on that record exactly in tune with the overtone series for the musical scale or mode or raga that corresponded to each serenade on the recording. So the recording itself is tuned exactly to the music.
What kind of equipment do you use in the studio?
I'm just using basic computer recording equipment. I use Pro Tools, but mostly Cubase, actually. It has some really nice mic preamps and really great mics. And it's mostly, though, about making the right decisions. That's the most important thing. If you can make the right decisions, the recording's going to come out great.
Two of my favorite artists when it comes to world music or new age or whatever you want to call it were guitarist Michael Hedges and the band Shadowfax. What are your thoughts regarding these early pioneers?
Yeah, I don't like labels either, which is why I coined the term world fusion music, because it describes a process and not a genre. And the process of world fusion music could create something that could fit in any genre. So I definitely don't like the term New Age. I always felt that was a really unfortunate naming of a genre of music after a philosophy movement. I would never have done that myself. And so I've never called my music New Age music. Kind of gets back to your earlier question of what I would have done had I not done Ancient Future. And I think perhaps if Ancient Future had not happened in California, the term New Age would never have been applied to us, because there weren't other artists around who were calling their music that, and then there wouldn't have been a trend for us to be lumped in with. And I think that would have actually been a very positive thing to have never, ever had that term associated with our music. But having said that, we were in California, and so we did actually perform on bills with both Michael Hedges and Shadowfax. And I can't say I've been influenced by either artist, although I really appreciate the guitar skills of Michael Hedges. He was an amazing artist, and it's very sad that he passed so early. Shadowfax was an ensemble on the Windham Hill record label, which I think they were also not so happy about that New Age label. If you got a chance to catch them live, they were a very interesting live band. And so it was fun playing I think it was just one bill that we played with them. It might have been two, but I definitely remember one. Again, the leader of that band, I think he passed away a little too early as well. So both artists, I think, did some really great work that was unfortunately classified as New Age music, and I don't think either of the artists felt right about that.
So now you're in the middle of celebrating 30 years of Ancient Future. What plans do you have for the band for the next 30 years?
What I'd really like to do for the next 30 years is to get more international in our effect and in our ability to bring people together. I'd love it if there was a support network and system and patrons and donors who could raise enough money so that we could bring together some top-level musicians from many different traditions for specific workshop situations where we maybe get together for a couple of months and learn each other's music and rehearse and then make a record and then go out on the road and perform the music from that record. And then the next year, do another event like that with another set of musicians. If we could do 30 events like that, one a year for the next 30 years, I think that would just be a wonderful thing for music and for Ancient Future. And just a matter of how can we get the support to do that. So if we can get enough fans who are willing to actually donate money directly, or if government grants for the arts increase, if society gets to the point where it says, yes, we need the arts in order to solve all of our problems, because we need that in our life. We need culture. We need to support cross-cultural collaboration, because that'll help and pay dividends in keeping our political situation stable so that humanity can meet all of its challenges. If that's the direction we move, I think we can do a lot. And so that's what I'm hoping for.
When you're writing material for Ancient Future, what inspires you?
Well, initially, the inspiration for the music in Ancient Future is definitely the traditions. And it's through studying those traditions that I gain musical knowledge that's used in my compositions. But when it comes to actually doing the composition, the inspiration might be something far more personal. It might be a relationship, it might be nature, it might be an experience I've just had. So the fusion actually happens in the subconscious in a way. It's by studying the traditions that you get the kernels of knowledge and the models in your brain that allow you to do certain things or know how certain forms of music work. And then when you create, it's almost like the music is just coming through you and you're expressing something else. So so the inspiration can be really anything, but it wouldn't happen if it wasn't for the work done first.
You spend so much time doing concerts and recording. I have to wonder, do you ever have any time to practice?
When I was young, I used to practice 4 to 9 hours a day. And those were the days I loved practicing that much. That's how I became a good musician early in my life, was by spending so many hours practicing. And I've kept up a practice schedule, but over the years, it's definitely dwindled down. The last 10 years have been very hard in that regard because of the changes in the music industry, losing the record labels and a lot of the support systems. I've had to use the computer to make up that and do a lot of computer work myself. And so it's really cut into my practice time. And I think it's really a shame. I'm really hoping that we come to a point in music where there's more support systems and structures set up to actually help musicians so that we can spend more time practicing, because that's really what it's all about. But I still practice, and I love practicing.
One thing that most musicians do during the course of their careers is teaching and mentoring other musicians. Do you ever have an opportunity to do this?
I'm actually very involved in teaching. I teach 2 days a week and have a lot of really great students I'm quite proud of. I feel that teaching is a huge responsibility of musicians. It's very important that the traditional knowledge that we have is passed down to new musicians, and that we train the next generation with great musical skills, so that the music will continue and grow. And at the same time, we also need people to teach basics of music to everyone, so that there's an audience for great music, because unless you know certain things about music, it's hard to appreciate it. So, you know, right now, music education seems to consist of watching YouTube videos and MTV and American Idol. And I don't think that's really doing the job. We need a good system in the schools. And so those teachers who are working in the schools, I really commend them for doing that work to bring the next generation the knowledge that they'll need in order to really appreciate music. So it's important not only that we train the next generation of musicians, but also that we develop an awareness among the general public about the basic forms of music, so that they can really appreciate the finer aspects of music.
Well, Matthew, I'd like to thank you for dropping by today. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show. And all the best in your future endeavors. I wish Ancient Future a healthy and a prosperous future, and I hope that you're going to continue making some great music.
Thanks so much for having me. You asked some really thoughtful questions, and so I had a really great time answering them.